Hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. We're delighted to welcome with us today Riverview Middle School of Sheboygan. Would the students please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. And you're joined with some students from the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater. Would they stand, please? Thank you. You may be seated. The students from the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater have come, not the same students, of course, but students have come for many years to observe the court in session. And we appreciate your coming and welcome you and your predecessors. The Riverview Middle Schools have come, and they are part of Court with Class, which is ordinarily run for the high school students of the state. Have the University of Wisconsin students gotten materials on this case? Okay. And if not, there's a summary of the case outside, and you should get it and read it. Have the middle school students gotten materials on this case? Yes. So that's good. You're all as prepared as the court. Good idea. It's a joke. So we're delighted to welcome you. And at noon, after this case is heard, all the students and everyone else who wishes to are welcome to meet with Justice Prosser here in the courtroom and discuss the procedures of this court. That will be after this case is concluded. So we've met you. I'd like to introduce the court to all of you, and I'll start with Justice Prosser, who is on my far right. Justice Prosser. Seated next to Justice Prosser is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. To my immediate right is Justice William Babich. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. Usually seated in the chair to my left is Justice John Wilcox, but he will not be participating in this case. And seated next to the empty chair is Justice Patrick Crooks, and to the far left is Justice Diane Sykes. With these introductions made, I will call this case 01-1715, Dora Alvarado versus Peter Sirsch. Arguing for the plaintiffs is Daniel Hildebrand, who will have 25 minutes and then an additional 5 in rebuttal. Mr. Hildebrand.
Thank you, Your Honor. I hope I'm as well prepared as the students, too.
We do, too, Mr. Hildebrand.
I would like to begin my argument by talking about a case that I read a long time ago, more than 40 years ago, when I was a law student, and that's the famous Paulsgraf case. And in that case, which I believe is still studied in the law school, the court in New York reached it was a very difficult case, and the facts, of course, are that this man was running for a train, and he had a little satchel or briefcase, and the guard or the trainman reached out to assist them, and unbeknownst, of course, to the trainman, there was an explosive in that satchel, and it was dropped, and there was an explosion, and Mrs. Paulsgraf, who was at the end of the platform, was injured by scales falling down upon her and inflicting some serious injuries, and Judge Cardozo ruled in favor of the defendant. And the essence of his ruling was, and I quote from the opinion, "The conduct of the defendant's guard, if a wrong in its relation to the holder of the package, was not a wrong in relation to the plaintiff standing far away. So Cardozo had a kind of a space and time limitation as to what happens when one is negligent. Now, the dissenting opinion of Judge Andrews, which has become through numerous decisions the law of Wisconsin, says that once there is negligence, then it extends to anybody. And there are no space and time concepts, at least insofar as the law of negligence is concerned. He made that very clear, and as recently as the Stevenson case said, and this is at 251 with second 171 in paragraph 16, I'm sorry I didn't cite it in my brief, every person owes a duty to the world at large to refrain from conduct that would cause foreseeable harm to others. And that is the law of Wisconsin. And we are here today to ask you to simply apply the law of Wisconsin as it has stood for many years as far as negligence is concerned. The essential point that I think defendant is trying to get across here is that this is unforeseeable because Dora Alvarado was a cleaning lady. She wasn't a tenant. But cases that have gone for many years through this court say it doesn't matter if there are unforeseeable consequences or an unforeseeable plaintiff. Mrs. Alvarado is an unforeseeable plaintiff. Maybe if this had happened when she was a tenant, that they argue would not have been unforeseeable. But Mrs. Alvarado is a cleaning lady. Therefore, we couldn't imagine that not discovering something in the apartment would harm a cleaning lady. So the point is here, if I were up here arguing for a tenant, I don't think this court would have any problem finding that this kind of negligence could be invoked to protect a tenant. But what about a cleaning lady? She is an unforeseeable plaintiff, and under the law of this court, she should be protected as well.
Mr. Hildebrand, let me just try and figure out, for my purposes, what your argument is. You accept the Paul's Graf minority view, is that it?
Yes.
As the court does, okay. You also accept, I assume, that the court can apply these six public policy factors to absolve a person of liability for negligence. You accept that as the law in the state?
Yes, it is, Your Honor.
And you accept that ordinarily the concepts of liability for negligence, that is, was it at negligent, was it causal, and were there damages, that those are jury questions of fact?
That is true.
And you didn't get a jury trial, and that's your objection.
Yes.
Okay.
This case was decided on summary judgment, and our contention is that there should be a jury trial.
Right. But here's my point, and this is where I'm pressing you. Suppose there was a jury trial, and suppose that the jury found that there was negligence, that is, there was a breach of ordinary care here, and that it was causal, and your client suffered damages, and awarded, and you can just fill in the blank, hundreds of thousands of dollars, or very few dollars, for the damage to her hand, right? Okay. Now, motions after verdict are that that the court should apply public policy considerations, right?
That's true.
And they now apply these six factors, the circuit court does, and concludes that, what was it, 1 and 3 apply, no liability, right?
Well, that's what the decision
okay,
is.
Okay, that was
yes.
The decision. So you would then appeal to the Court of Appeals and say, doesn't fall within 1 through 6, right?
Right.
And you might lose, as you did in the Court of Appeals here, right?
Well, except we'd have a full trial record there to go on, unlike what happened here.
That's my bottom line, and that's my point. Then you come up here, and if that happened, that you got a jury verdict on negligence and liability, you would be fighting here on 6 factors.
That would be true.
Okay. So, haven't we done you a favor? Or hasn't the Court of Appeals done you a favor by saying, look, why waste the time of going through a trial? We are going to assume there's been negligence. We're going to assume causation. We're going to assume significant damages. And you got the verdict you wanted, Mr. Hildebrand, but 1 through 6, 1 and 3 apply. So aren't you better off? Because what you've done is avoided the expenses of a trial. Not only you have avoided the expenses of trial, but the defendant has avoided the expenses of trial, and the court has avoided the expense and time of a trial. So why don't we just talk about those 6?
Well, first of all, there are 2 answers to the question. One answer of which is that there should be a trial in this case, because I don't think that on a motion for summary judgment, counsel, plaintiff's counsel, defense counsel should be required to disgorge all the permutations and expert witnesses and all of that stuff that would be coming out in a full-blown trial. And one of the things that my opponent said in his brief was he characterized one of the experts who did furnish an affidavit in support of or in opposition to defendant's motion for summary judgment, claiming that it was ridiculous or ludicrous. And on summary judgment, the trial court, nor should appellate courts, be required to determine whether or not expert opinions are ludicrous or not.
But, counsel, to get to the Court of Appeals position or the circuit court's position, they assume you're going to win. Why are you fighting that they're going to let you win on negligence?
I'm not fighting that they're going to win on negligence. They would win on negligence, and I'm trying to say that a public policy decision here should not be made without a trial. And I would respectfully point out that I think one of the cases that's quite close to this one is the Coffey case, which involved a negligent building inspector who didn't find something that eventually caused a fire. And this court said, we aren't going to determine the public policy factors on demur. That was, I think, a motion to dismiss case. But there's a lot of things that can go on as far as what is involved in building inspections, et cetera. And I'm telling you that I think the same thing applies to someone who in our situation negligently inspected a building when it was during a move-out inspection type of situation.
Well, Mr. Hildebrand, you might have an alternative answer that's popped into my mind, and that is that if you have a trial, the jury itself is asked to determine negligence, and the negligence instruction seems to encompass at least 2 and maybe 3 of those public policy factors, so that in fact the jury has told the reviewing courts, including this court, that they don't find it too highly extraordinary. That's the number 3 one. Or they don't find that this is too remote from the negligence because they're finding negligence. Is that an addition? I think that's a legitimate response. I don't know if it carries much water. But
well,
what's your response to that?
Well, I think that is essentially true because, as this court has said in a number of opinions, that the public policy, particularly remoteness and some of these other ones, is confined by the fact that the plaintiff has to prove negligence and cause in fact. So once that is proven, that sort of puts a shell around what has actually happened here. In other words, the defendant can get up and say, oh, we have absolutely no idea that there was a firecracker in the cupboard, and the jury might want to evaluate that. Or
well, that leads again to another, and maybe it's sort of a thumb sucking question, but that is maybe all these years that we've been reserving to ourselves the right to determine these 6 public policy questions, maybe we should let the jury decide at least 2 or 3 of them, in which the question of reasonable foreseeability are encompassed. What do you think of that?
Well, I think the jury does have to make that kind of a decision in order to come to the verdict either one way or another.
But we have the right to overrule them. We can simply say as a matter of public policy, number one applies, and they shouldn't have done it. But as I guess we have agreed upon, the jury has already said, well, it's not too remote or it's not too extraordinary. Maybe I'm getting too far.
Well, the traditional law in Wisconsin, of course, is that this court and, well, any court can make the public policy decision, and the question is what you make it on. Do you make it on a demur? Do you make it on a full record? Or do you make it on summary judgment? And I'm suggesting here that this is the kind of a case where it should be made only after all the facts are brought out at trial. Now
let me raise one other problem, then I'll sit down and be quiet. What troubles me in these cases, and we've had a lot of them, is that I think all the attorneys that stand before us and argue them recognize that at some point there's a disconnect, that this linkage doesn't go on forever. And here we've got the inspectors who left who didn't discuss, or the painters who left it and the inspectors who didn't, and then the third linkage is your client. She blows it up. And you're arguing that that linkage is not too remote, it's not too extraordinary, et cetera, so that there's no disconnect between them. But now just carry this out. What if instead of lighting it, she takes it home, gives it to her kids thinking it's a candle, and the kids blow it up? Or take it another step. She takes it home, gives it to her kids take it to school, and somebody at the school blows it up. You know, at some point, there's a disconnect. And to me, the issue in these cases is, frequently, where does that occur? Where does the linkage break?
Well, I can't say where the linkage in this case would break, but certainly it wouldn't break in the apartment itself where the firecracker wasn't found.
And why not?
Because I think as a practical matter, the landlord and the property manager in this case undertook a responsibility to inspect that apartment. And I do want to quote to you from this operating manual because it's a big, thick record. But one of the jobs of the property manager here, the supervisor was, and I'll read this, handle details of resident move-in and move-out, giving special attention to apartment preparedness. Ensure that residents are provided with a safe, well-maintained community. So right here in their manual, they say, we want safety for the tenant. And my challenge, I think, to the defendant as well as to this court, why should it be limited to tenants? That gets it right back to the problem in Paul's graph. Then the other thing that they say in their manual, continually inspect property and improvements for curb appeal, protection of property value, and potential safety hazards. This is right in their manual. So, again, this gets us back to Paul's graph problem. I mean, Mrs. Alvarado is perhaps like the woman who was injured by the scales that fell off after the explosion because the railroad was presumably more concerned about its passengers and people getting on the train than it was somebody standing on the platform. Well, Mrs. Alvarado was standing on the platform and was seriously injured. And they say, oh, you know, she's an unforeseeable plaintiff, and we don't have any responsibility to the plaintiff. And Judge Andrews in this court has said, you have a responsibility to the world at large if you commit an act of negligence and it causes an injury.
Except if you violate one of those six public policies.
Yes. And as far as I can see, I mean, I can certainly tick down the public policies, it's not remote. It's certainly is causal. This isn't, as Justice Babich suggested, Dora takes the candle home and it goes to school and all of that, and there's an explosion in the school. This was right in the apartment. And my opponent says, well, what if it was a poisonous snake? Or what if it was a chemical? I mean, you see, they say, well, there was never an explosive there, but it could be anything. It could be rat poison. Or it could be something, some noxious chemical that would burn off your skin. In other words, The error of the defense in this case is that we will take any case and we will compartmentalize it and say that nothing like this ever happened before, and therefore there's no responsibility. And with all due respect, I would say that's the one kick at the cat theory which has never been adopted by this court. In other words, the next time some poor person goes into an apartment and blows off her hand or gets somebody, I'll say, well, you knew this would happen because you had this prior case. But that's not the law, with all due respect to my opponents.
Tell me
what's the logical stopping point here? Let's say instead of your client who was cleaning the apartment, that there were a series of students who came in to look at the apartment. To decide whether or not to rent the apartment. Should they be able to recover if they had lit the candle?
Absolutely.
The fireworks?
It's not at all remote, because it's the whole purpose, as I read from the manual, is to protect property value and potential safety hazards. This isn't cases in the comparative negligence field. This isn't somebody who's tampering with an elevator and gets hurt. It's not a trespasser. It's someone that was expected to be there and was there. So I would say that would include cleaning persons, maintenance persons, tenants, guests of tenants, prospective tenants.
So in other words, a stopping point would be anybody who was there legally or appropriately with permission. Is that your stopping
and
point?
Well, that would certainly be well within the realm. I don't know how it would go beyond that, but certainly if you decide this case on public policy, that there is no public policy that would bar it, that would not say that someone who takes a firecracker to school out of one of these vacant apartments wouldn't. That would be a different case.
But what about if someone broke into the apartment and wanted to have some light to look around, see what was available to take, and ended up lighting what they thought was the candle, and it was the fireworks?
That might be a different case. I'm not so sure that it is. But the point of it is, when you focus on what the defendant expects that there are going to be people in that apartment. And the defendant expects that we are going to have safe apartments here. And the defendant expects that there's going to be responsibility on the property manager to inspect those apartments, as I read out of the manual. So if someone who is not necessarily lawfully in but expected to be there gets hurt because there was negligence in failing to find something highly dangerous, whether it be a chemical, a firecracker, or a rattlesnake, if you will, or a bear in the closet, I mean, you can conjure up all sorts of things.
Sounds to me like you're arguing, at least for purposes of this case, that the cutoff point, the disconnect, doesn't occur until you have exhausted the reasonably foreseeable users or frequenters.
That would certainly be true, and that's why I cannot understand why the public policy aspects of this case wouldn't be fairly obvious. To me, it's like the Walmart case and the analysis that the court made in the Walmart case. I mean, these people, like the Walmart folks, are in the business of providing safe apartments. That is their business. This isn't like the woman who sat by the fire and didn't put it out and a little kid's hand got burnt and all of that. These folks are in the business of providing safe apartments, and my client was in there lawfully, and something terrible happened to her. Admittedly, it was an unusual accident, but the law of negligence doesn't protect people against defendants from paying for unusual accidents.
If we should hold for you and send this back to trial, does that end the issue of public policy, or can the defendant again ask that public policy be applied?
That would be up to the court. In Schuster versus Altenburg, that was the case involving the psychologist or psychiatrist that didn't warn about someone who was dangerous. The court resolved the policy issues in favor of the plaintiff in that case and sent it back. I mean, this Court has a lot of flexibility.
What are you suggesting the Court do?
I'm suggesting the Court find that there's nothing in Wisconsin's public policy that would bar Dora Alvarado from recovering. Because if you go through the factors and look at them, there is nothing in the public policy of this state that would bar her from recovering. Remember, the public policy is shocking the conscience of society. I don't think it shocks the conscience of society to say that the owner and manager of an apartment shouldn't be responsible for this sort of thing.
Well, but you have an alternative argument. If we don't hold in your favor on that, then you want us to say it's not timely to rule on public policy. And there are conflicting theories there.
That's true.
Okay. So
but the other thing, if I may, Your Honor, is that if this case goes back to trial, this Court, as well as the trial court, court of appeals, et cetera, may well benefit from the kind of expert opinion that could come out as to what is reasonable for an apartment owner to do.
That's the alternative theory.
Yes.
That we don't have enough facts. Then my question to you is, what kind of facts would change this equation here? What can happen at trial that's going to make public policy move one way or another?
What can happen is that you would have a full panoply of everybody knows what happened in the apartment.
That's why I'm asking you the question, Mr. Hildebrand.
Yeah, but what I'm suggesting is you would have the full panoply of experts that would be brought in by the plaintiff as well as by the defendant as
in
to
what
is reasonable for an apartment owner manager to do.
And what would your experts say, hypothetically?
Hypothetically, the expert would say that it's an ordinary function of a landlord property manager to inspect apartments and make sure that there's nothing hazardous in those apartments so that tenants and frequenters would not suffer serious injury. This would be the way apartment people run their apartments. This would be completely consistent with the way these folks were supposed to run their apartments.
Hildebrand, you want a jury trial.
Yes, Your Honor.
What is the source? Do you have a right to a jury trial?
In a negligence case, yes.
What about summary judgment?
Well, a summary judgment, obviously there's no jury trial because the facts are agreed to and there's no issues of fact.
So...
But here there are issues of fact, I contend.
So you don't have any problem with any time the Court finds there are no issues of disputed fact, the jury trial disappears?
Well, in a negligence case, it is very, I mean, there's cases which we've cited in our brief that says it's a very, very difficult thing to avoid, to have some summary judgment granted in a negligence case. And the reason for that is that we're talking about things like foreseeability and duty and standards of care. This is what the jury is for. The jury is the representative of the community that sit in judgment of other people's conduct. It's like guilt or innocence in a criminal case, in negligence. My distinguished opponent would argue, we had no reason to expect that there'd be a firecracker in there. And my colleague would argue at trial, well, they should have inspected more carefully. And then the jury will sit there and evaluate, well, what do we as citizens of this community expect of people who are in the business of renting and leasing property? And they make that judgment, and it's a very important part of our system. And that's why in all the variety of cases that involve the law of negligence, that is why it is so important to get that input from the members of our community that are called upon to sit on juries. And I think that's why this Court says it's a very unusual case to have summary judgment in a negligence case. And I think this is why. The opinions don't really articulate that, but this is why I think that's the reason for the rule, and I think it's a sound rule. I see my red light is on.
If I could, may, Mr. Hildebrand, I'm not quite sure whether this case is primarily about this last point, the jury trial in this context, the procedural right, and when you make the decision about public policy,
or whether it's really a case about substance. What is the public policy, and what is the duty, and what is negligence? Or is it all of those things?
I think it's all of them. But returning to public policy, again, the public policy is simply a break on the juries. It's just that. In other words, if a jury comes up with a bizarre verdict that shocks, that in the opinion of this court, shocks the conscience of society, then we're going to take the right of the jury away. But it's got to shock the conscience of society. In this case, awarding recovery to Mrs. Alvarado does not shock the conscience of society, in my opinion.
Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand. You have 5 minutes rebuttal. Mr. Nelson, representing Oakbrook Corporation, ABC, Unidentified Insurance Company, Merida Retirement, and OHIC Insurance.
Thank you, Chief Justice.
Good morning.
Good morning. The summary judgment in this case should be affirmed because whether one applies the duty of care analysis, as was done by Judge Bartel in the trial court, or applies the public policy considerations, as did the Court of Appeals, or both, there are no genuine issues of material fact, and the defendants are entitled to judgment as a matter of law.
So do you disagree with the Court of Appeals' opinion that we essentially are at the state in this, we are at the stage of this case in which we just, for we don't look at duty and simply jump right to the policy questions?
I have a little more trouble with that jump by the Court of Appeals, Justice Bablich. I think there's three real issues in the case. To me, one is, was the trial court correct in finding no breach of duty by Larry Kelleher when he did his move-out inspection, which I believe that the trial court was correct, and I think it was a very well-reasoned opinion by Judge Bartel. The second issue, did the Court of Appeals appropriately apply the public policy considerations? And again, I think they did. I think there's a third issue, and I believe that's probably why I'm here before this court at this time, and that is the Court of Appeals correct in finding that the issue of duty of care is now to be analyzed under the public policy considerations? Before I address that, I think whatever the determination of that third issue does not change the underlying facts and the appropriateness of summary judgment in this case. My answer to the last question, whether the Court of Appeals correctly, were they correct in finding that the issue of duty of care is now analyzed under public policy, I've gone from no to maybe to probably in my review of this case. Let me just, if I could, outline my thoughts as I look through the cases of the Supreme Court. I had some hesitancy to agree that we should not look at the issue of duty, and particularly duty, I think, as exemplified by the McNeese versus Peer case. My hesitancy
Mr.
is...
Nelson, if I might, let me interrupt you for a minute before you get too far into the cases. Wisconsin has a number of cases where we've said that taking away a jury verdict should be something that we do rarely. In other words, applying the six public policy factors and taking away a jury verdict is not something we should allow as a matter of course. If that's true, then why shouldn't there be a jury trial before those public policy factors are applied? Why should we take the approach that the Court of Appeals took?
Because I think basic in our jurisprudence in this state, and I think I would highlight the case of Morgan versus Pennsylvania General Insurance Company, that if there's no legislative enactment covering a particular situation, or there's no decision by a court of appeal, by an appellate court, defining what is or is not negligent under the condition or circumstance, The fundamental law in this state is the trial judge may withdraw a case from a jury whenever the jury could not reasonably find the defendant's conduct to be negligent. And I think if we look at this case and analyze it under the framework of the cases enunciated by this Court, in my mind, there is an absence of negligence in the case. There was no breach of any duty as a matter of law. And I believe that's what Judge Bartel specifically held in this case. So I think inherent in our system is that, yes, it may be a rare occasion, but more and more, in my review, it has come to the point where cases such as this are normally handled in unpublished opinions by the Court of Appeals. I know that the day after I finished writing my brief, the Court of Appeals came down with a case specifically on lack of foreseeability in a case, therefore no duty, therefore no liability. So it might be rare, but it should not be that uncommon to restrain a court from, if as a matter of law, the defendants are entitled to judgment. I think this Court has said it not only is a right, but it's an obligation of the Court to say there should be no trial. They should not put all the defendants through trial unless there is either an issue of fact or an issue of law.
Well, our cases also say that negligence normally is a fact that should be determined by the trier of fact. In other words, that normally the jury should find whether or not there is or is not negligence. And how do you reconcile that line of cases with what the Court of Appeals did here?
Well, Justice Crooks, I think the analysis of the case that I would respond to is that, as did Mrs. Alvarado's complaint, as did the standards in the Antoine A. case, the real key, as enunciated by Judge Bartel, was whether Larry Kelleher or the defendants knew or should have known of the presence of the explosive device in the kitchen cabinet. If there are no facts upon which a reasonable jury could find that Kelleher knew or should have known, I think that's what this case is, and that would be my answer, that if a trial court or appellate court or certainly this court could find that as a matter of law, then the defendants are entitled to judgment. On summary judgment, I noticed in looking at all the cases that many times there are issues that are not fully developed in the record on either summary judgment or in years past on demur or motion to dismiss, where the court has said, I don't think summary judgment is appropriate on this record because we don't have all the facts. But I think in this case, Your Honor, the case is well developed. You have the benefit of all the affidavits, of all the pleadings. This is a very large and intense record, and I think all the answers really have been put forth to both the trial court and the Court of Appeals. I also want to mention that the issue is one of ordinary care of Mr. Kelleher in conducting his move-out inspection, and I believe the test of negligence, as adopted by the trial court in this case, certainly by this court, is whether the conduct in question foreseeably creates an unreasonable risk of harm to others. And in saying this, this court has enunciated that the harm must be reasonably foreseeable as probable, not merely possible.
Counsel?
Yes.
Let me push that a bit. Let's assume that instead of this damage to I think she was a cleaning lady.
Yes, she was.
Here, let's assume that, was it the painters that left the fireworks?
That's correct, DP okay. Painters.
Did they discover it, or was it there? I just forget.
They discovered it by, okay. According to their testimony, standing on top of the ledge and painting the ceiling. They happened to notice in an upper cabinet, mm-hmm. halfway back.
And then they took it out and put it on a counter or something.
That's correct, either
well,
there or...
Let's assume the cleaning lady does nothing with it. She just leaves it there. And the next day, according to the signed contract, a new student moves into this apartment. And this new student decides to have a fire lit candle dinner that night.
and sees this candle sitting on the table, lights it and explodes and causes serious damage to the new tenant. Would your arguments be the same, that there is no liability to this tenant?
No, they would not be.
And why is that?
Justice Baelish, because I think we're missing a lot between the cup and the lip in that hypothetical. And again, I think...
Could you say that then that your client is liable to the tenant?
Well, let me just explain that by knowing what would happen between the initial move-out inspection, having the painters, the cleaners, and representatives of Oakbrook coming in for a move inspection before tenants would be allowed to be in there. So I think one must look at the context of this case and these particular circumstances.
I'm giving you the facts. Forget this case. Let's get another case where we got another apartment and there's an inspection and they fail to find this firecracker. It's M250 is left out in the open and the cleaning lady does nothing with it. It's sitting there and the tenant comes in and lights it to have a candlelit dinner. Are you saying that this is too remote?
Well, I think that would be a different case, Justice Baelish.
Well, then answer my different case, please.
Yeah, I do think it would be different because...
I know it's different. That's why I posed it. Could you give me a yes or no? Would they be liable?
I believe they probably would be liable.
Okay.
Because that would be implicit in providing new tenants rather than the people who are there to clean as part of the process to make sure that when they rent the apartment out, it will be safe for the new tenants. And I think that's what's different in this case.
But answering Justice Baelish's question, would you say there should be a jury trial, or you can do it as a matter of law the way Judge Bartel did?
In his hypothetical?
Mm-hmm.
I think there probably would be issues of fact in that context.
No, all the facts are undisputed. The only thing that's disputed is whether there's negligence and liability. No dispute of facts, just like there's no dispute of facts here, as I understand the case.
Well, I guess, I can only assume that there should be some facts to determine whether there was additional proceedings by the apartment owners or Oakbrook, the management company, Chief Justice. So it's hard.
Let me follow up on Justice Baelish's question, if I may. You are making a distinction in part based on who is injured, the tenant as opposed to a cleaning person.
Well, I'm not sure if I want to make that distinction.
Okay.
The distinction, Justice Bradley, really is in the timing and what it puts in context what the move-out inspection should be and whether there's a foreseeable risk of injury at that point.
Let me then, just for clarification, I want to ask you about the Rockwhite case, but before that, for clarification, let's say the facts are exactly the facts here.
Yes, ma'am.
Except the cleaning person does nothing with the firecracker or whatever, fireworks, and a tenant moves in the next day and uses it for the romantic candlelight dinner described by Justice Baelish. Is there a potential there? Is there a difference in analysis because one is the tenant a day later rather than the cleaning lady?
No, I don't believe there would be a difference in analysis, but again, based on the hypothetical that the candle is brought out or the firework is brought out and left in open view, I don't think that changes whether there was a foreseeable risk of injury, unreasonable risk of injury, at the time when Larry Kelleher did his move-out inspection.
Okay. I guess let me get to my question, and maybe this will assist me in understanding this. When I look at Rockwhite, it defines the obligation of due care to refrain from any act which will cause foreseeable harm to others. That's consistent with the definition that you just gave earlier, whether conduct in question foreseeably, et cetera, et cetera. But Rockwright goes on to say, then, will cause foreseeable harm to others, even though the nature of that harm and the identity of the harmed person is unknown at the time of the act. So is that a correct statement of the law, which I just read to you?
I believe it is under A investment, Justice Bradley.
Thank you. And indeed, they probably, I don't know if they cite that, but you're right, it's one of the many. In fact, it's a string cite. I don't know if they do AE investment. But so in my tenant hypothetical, I'm going to call it mine now if you don't mind.
Sure.
Thanks. In my tenant hypothetical, there would be no way that a tenant could maintain a cause of action in this case. It's your position.
Based on your now hypothetical that incorporates
same facts, cleaning lady doesn't touch it, though. Tenant moves in next day, touches it, lights it as a candle.
Unless there was some other cause of action based on safe place or policy grounds that tenants are to be given safe premises, which I think is a fair conclusion. But I don't think that the act, in essence, of Larry Kelleher that we are looking at in this case, I don't think that act could be faulted, because I don't think at that point there was a reasonable foreseeability of unreasonable risk.
To anyone.
To
whether
anyone.
Whether it's a cleaning lady or a tenant.
To anyone. Yes, and I think the undisputed facts in this case, that the inspection was made in the context of a routine student turnaround, there's no suggestion that the tenant had ever been a problem tenant, no suggestion that the tenant was involved in any unusual, dangerous, or illegal activities during the tenancy. Larry Kelleher observed nothing unusual about the apartment. In fact, it was vacant to the eye.
Your opposing counsel, though, suggests there will be disputed facts when and if he gets a chance to go to trial, and that is he'll have an expert witness who will say, look, the standard of care is this. I'm employed in the business to manage properties, and as a routine, the practice in the industry is and should be that we check for hazardous materials. Is there any loaded gun left in the closet? Is there firework left on, you know, wherever, you know, which is obviously unique. But if you have, as your opposing counsel asserts, expert testimony in that fashion, won't there be then an issue of fact as to what is the standard of care?
Well, first of all, in summary judgment, they did put in testimony of their expert, and we have heard that, and Judge Bartel looked at that and considered it, as did the Court of Appeals.
And Judge Bartel said there was no duty owed.
Yes, she did, because she found that there was no breach of any duty.
Now, I thought that she found no duty. You earlier said she found no breach of duty, but on Appendix 21, and I may there may be other things that I'm not looking at here, but Appendix 21, she says, the facts adduced by Oakbrook and Meritor support defendant's position that neither could have reasonably foreseen the presence of the firework and therefore owed no duty to Alvarado. And so I thought that was the basis of her opinion, that there was no duty owed, but maybe there's something else.
Could I read from at least A30? In the absence of foreseeability that the checkout inspection performed to close off the relationship with the previous tenant and to prepare the premises for occupancy by the new tenant would subject others to a reasonable risk of harm or injury, Oakbrook did not, as a matter of law, violate any duty to exercise reasonable care in its inspection of apartment 303.
That seems to be perhaps different than what I read on page 821, her finding there is no duty in A30, a violation of a duty. Violation of a duty assumes a duty initially exists in order
yes.
to be violated.
Yes, and I think what I found interesting is I know my esteemed opponent had said that Judge Bartel used a very shallow scope of negligence, but I think if one were to read the other portion of her decision dealing with DP painters, I think the law as expressed in that opinion was right on point. It talked about the AE investment case and the scope and the duty, and I think that was employed both as to my client defendants and to DP painters, who, as the Court will recall, Judge Bartel found that indeed there was a duty and that there was triable issues of material fact for the jury, not only on that issue, but also on public policy grounds. And I think that's because there is that factual difference between the two sets of defendants that in my portion of the case dealing with Oakbrook, that there are no material issues or genuine issues of material fact. And I frankly think the both the Court of Appeals and the trial court were quite correct and in accordance with the precedent of this Court in granting summary judgment.
I look again at page 830, and you made reference to that. On the top of 830, the first paragraph, I conclude that Oakbrook was under no enhanced duty to inspect apartment 303. So I am a bit perplexed because you very correctly point to the language on A30 that says that Oakbrook did not violate any duty, but I've just pointed out two places where she says there's no duty or no enhanced duty. So it causes me pause to know exactly.
I believe a fair reading of her decision is that she found the absence of breach by Larry Kelleher.
Mm-hmm. She and found duty, though. You're saying she found duty.
Well, I believe she found duty in the sense that in Wisconsin, under the minority view in Paul's graph, everyone owes a duty to everyone. Yes, so there is a duty. But in the context of this case, she found there is
no negligence. She found no negligence as a matter of law.
She found no negligence because of the lack of foreseeability under the circumstances in this case.
And you agree with that?
I would agree with that, Justice Bradley. And frankly, I think this court's pronunciation in McNeese versus Peer is one that should be reviewed, because in that case, that was the case where the mother was picking up children and she parked across the street, which the court noted that although maybe it was foreseeable that the young child may have to cross to get to the car waiting to take her for school, however, it's got to be an unreasonable risk. And the court found in that case insufficient evidence to support a finding that the defendant acted or failed to act at a time when it was reasonably foreseeable that doing so would subject someone to an unreasonable risk of injury. What I found in this case, if I could just speak briefly about the Court of Appeals decision, because to me, I believe, and I would recommend that the Court study both the Court of Appeals decision and Judge Bartel's opinion, because I think, frankly, they're well-founded and well-based in precedent.
Well, I want to talk about the Court of Appeals decision, because when you started your various points, you indicated, or at least I heard, and maybe I misheard, that you had some reservations about the Court of Appeals decision.
I certainly do in this respect,
tell me what they are.
Chief Justice. particular with respect to whether there can be a finding by a trial court or a court of appeals that there is no duty because there was no foreseeability. And I believe some of my initial hesitation in reviewing that is I looked also at your concurrence. I forget where I saw that now.
Maybe in Rockwhite?
I think it was in Rockwhite, exactly, where you said in Wisconsin it's the doctrine of public policy, not the doctrine of duty, that limits the scope of the defendant's liability, which would be consistent with what the Court of Appeals was saying. However, in that same case, the majority opinion said, although individuals generally owe a duty of ordinary care to all persons, we recognize that limitations do exist with respect to the imposition of a legal duty in some cases, citing McNeese versus Peer. And so some of my hesitation came from, number one, most of the cases talking about public policy say that that should be applied after negligence, cause, and damages have been found. However, as I looked further, for instance, in Walkner versus Bignall, the court looked and said, well, I don't think we have to get into the foreseeability aspect of cutting shrubs along a roadway to see whether there's negligence. We'll go right to public policy. So, of course, the court has done that, and I believe that's what the court did in Rockwhite as well. All in all, the more I looked and the more I inquired into the Court of Appeals decision, I certainly found that it followed all of the cases of this court for the past 50 years or so. And I do believe that it came to the appropriate conclusions that indeed trial courts should apply public policy considerations. Now, it's not without some questions on my mind, because does that mean that a trial court has to apply public policy rather than the finding of McNeese versus Peer? And that's my hesitancy, because I think a trial court could, as Judge Bartel did in this case, find there was no duty because there was no foreseeability of an unreasonable risk of harm to anyone. So that's my hesitation in.
You're beginning to lose me. In response to Justice Bradley, your position was Judge Bartel found that there was no negligence.
Yes.
That obviously your clients owe a duty of due care to everybody.
Correct.
But they didn't breach that duty in this case, said Judge Bartel, because you don't expect them to view the apartment and examine the apartment in such a way as to remove everything and realize that this was a dangerous event, element.
I think at that point in time, in a move-out inspection, that's correct.
Okay. So that she says there's no breach, right?
Yes.
And that's what you agree with?
I do agree with that.
And she finds it as a matter of law and takes it away from the jury?
I agree with that as well.
Okay. Now, the Court of Appeals says we don't have to go that. We don't have to go there. We don't have to decide whether it was negligent or not. At least that's a reading of the Court of Appeals. It may not be the only reading. Court says, hey, we're not going to look at negligence. We're not going to look at breach of care. We're not going to look at causation. We're not going to look at damages. We're just going to say, look, here are the facts, and you guys don't dispute the facts. She's the cleaning lady. She goes in. There is a firecracker left by a tenant, some tenant or other, and yet she's injured, right?
Yes.
No dispute of facts. And the Court of Appeals says, on that basis of these undisputed facts, even if this is a breach of the standard of care, doesn't matter. Public policy says it's too remote. You agree with that, too?
I believe that's what they said. However,
right.
I think there is a nexus between the trial court and the Court of Appeals, because implicitly, well, actually explicitly, the Court of Appeals found that there was a lack of foreseeability, even though they couched it in terms of the public policy factors 1 and 3. They said explicitly that we find a lack of foreseeability of unreasonable harm.
And do you think that statement goes to standard of care, breach of the standard of care?
The statement as to foreseeability?
Yes.
Yes, I do.
So you think that they're really saying the same thing as
I believe so, yes. That's my reading, that the Court of Appeals said, we concur with Judge Bartel, there was lack of foreseeability of injury to anyone.
Is it the same kind of foreseeability that is encompassed within the negligence jury instruction?
Yes, it is, Justice Babich. I think exactly. That calls for the same principles. There must be a foreseeability of unreasonable harm to anyone. And I don't think that's – I think the Court of Appeals saw that, recognized it, and said, you're right, trial court, there was no foreseeability. However, we believe the Supreme Court has told us we must couch it in terms of the 6 public policy considerations. I think that's what the essence of this case is.
If you were going to write the opinion for this court, what would you say?
I would say that there are – number one, there are no disputed issues of fact, and the record is sufficient for us to – apply well the precedents of this court. Number two, indeed there was no foreseeable risk of unreasonable injury to anyone during the inspection of Mr. Kelleher.
Therefore,
there is no breach of any duty.
No breach of the standard of care.
Yes. And number three, that public policy considerations were appropriately applied, given that...
Why do you have to get to public policy if you've already found no negligence?
That gets back to maybe where I lost you, because I think there are cases where you can find no breach, so therefore no duty. But the Court of Appeals is saying that we must couch them in terms of the public policy factors, and that's my hesitation initially in looking at the Court of Appeals decision.
Well, my point to you is that if you find that there was no breach of the standard of care, you find no negligence, no liability, so you never have to get to public policy.
That's correct. However, as this Court has done in other cases, even if you were to find negligence, you could look at the public policy factors. On the facts in this case, that should be affirmed as well.
Justice Babich.
I want to get back to that prickly hypothetical of mine and just change it a little bit. Let's take the facts of this case, except let's eliminate the cleaning lady. Let's assume that after this inspection, you know, the painting and all that, everything is the same, and the tenant comes in. And the tenant looks at this and says, boy, that's a nice candle, and let's have a candlelit dinner. Now, is there liability to the tenant? Can the tenant recover?
My intuition would be that a court could look at that and say, as a matter of public policy, we think before new tenants are allowed to obtain leaseholds, that a landlord has a responsibility to provide a safe environment. I think a court could say that. And that's why maybe I'm failing, but I'm trying to tell where we are in this case as opposed to tenants down the road, and I don't think they're the same.
Well, why isn't the tenant in the exact same position as the cleaning lady? The tenant in my example, in which I eliminate the cleaning lady, why isn't there's no other linkage? You know, the linkage is exactly the same, and the tenant comes in, and you're saying, and I think correctly so, that there's probably liability to the tenant, but what's the difference between the tenant and the cleaning lady?
Well, I think because in the context of this case, the cleaning lady, the painters, are there to perform the very things that will make the tenancy safe for new tenants. I think the Court of Appeals hit it pretty well on the head by saying if Kelleher is negligent by doing that, it means that any time somebody would call in a contractor, whether the apartment is vacant or present, someone from Oak Brook would have to come in and inspect the premises to make sure it's safe for that independent contractor. And I think they also spoke to the fact that independent contractors, cleaning people in essence, probably should be as well aware of potential hazardous devices, which makes this case even more remote, because it's a device that looks like a candle. So I think on the
sounds to me like you're saying contributory negligence. That their obligation, not the landlord's, the cleaning people's obligation and whoever hires them, is to be aware that there may be such dangers and that they should take reasonable precautions.
I didn't mention it prior in my argument, Chief Justice, but yes, I did believe and I briefed that issue, that I believe as a matter of law, Mrs. Alvarado, who unfortunately suffered the injury, I believe, as a matter of law, her negligence did exceed that of Larry Kelleher in his inspection of the apartment. Thank you.
May I ask one final question? With regard to the Court of Appeals opinion, by way of preface, I understand our case law to be as set forth in the concurrence in Rock White in this fashion, citing AE Investment. It is. The consistent analysis of this court reveals that the question of duty is not an element of the court's policy determination. They're distinct. Yet the Court of Appeals, in paragraphs 22, raises the question and says, hey, now because of these two recent cases, we think that the concept of duty is no longer distinct, but instead part of the public policy analysis. Perhaps this is, since you don't have this right in front of you, might be difficult for you to answer. But it seems to me that that's inconsistent with what was referred to as the consistent analysis of this court, that they are distinct and that duty is not an element of the court's policy. Public policy.
That, frankly, Justice Bradley, was one of my initial hesitations in proofing what the Court of Appeals had opined. I had some hesitancy about that. I mean, there's two or three things that I had some hesitancy, but I think overall, the more I read and the more I looked at the pronouncements of this court. But yes, that and whether negligence, must be applied before applying the public policy factors, there are some issues that led me to wonder and question the Court of Appeals. I would also just like to cite that Wilson versus Continental Insurance Company, I was fumbling before, but for the pronouncement, there is no legal duty and thus no liability for negligence unless there is a foreseeable harm. And I think really that's what both Judge Bartel and the Court of Appeals found, that there was no foreseeable harm in Larry Kelleher's conduct in looking in his inspection of the premises. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counsel. Mr. Hildebrand.
I think that the central difference between the plaintiff's and the defendant's arguments or analysis of the case comes down to this. The defendants say that Kelleher, the property manager, had no reason to foresee that there was a firecracker in the cabinet. What the plaintiffs are saying and what I'm trying to persuade the court is that is really not the issue. The issue is, can it be foreseen that a failure to inspect a property during an apartment during a move-out inspection could reveal some kind of hazardous substance, whether it be a loaded gun, a poison, a firecracker, whatever. And I think that is the test. And
as to what?
as to whether or not there's a duty of care. And I think that that's where the trial court made an essential mistake here. Now, what I read to you out of the operating manual before is, it's on Bates stamp page, it's Exhibit 6 to Donald Murphy's affidavit. But I read to you job description property manager, and this is Mr. Kelleher. And Mr. Kelleher was supposed to continually inspect property improvements for curb appeal, protection of property value, and potential safety hazards. Potential safety hazards. How can these people come into court and say that we don't have any duty or responsibility to inspect apartments when they undertake to inspect the apartments to find potential safety hazards? That whole, again, it's the tendency of a defense to just look at the facts of a particular accident and say it was unusual, or we couldn't foresee that it was the cleaning lady instead of the tenant. So, but that is not the law of negligence. Now, my opponent relies very heavily on the McNeese case, but that was decided after trial. He cited Morgan. That was sent back for a trial. He mentioned Walker versus Bignell. That's the case where this court on a summary judgment held that there was no on public policy that communities didn't have the responsibility of cutting vegetation along roads. But recently this court decided the physician's insurance case where it involved a particular obstruction by vegetation of a stop sign at a marked intersection. And there, of course, the public policy was much different. And the trial court here analyzed, and the court said, well, there's no public policy here. If you put up a stop sign, you have some responsibility of making sure that it can be seen by the motorists.
That was a nuisance case, wasn't it?
That's right. But this court in that case said that you're going to apply the public policy and negligence cases to this kind of a nuisance case. So there's really no difference.
Had this case been brought in under nuisance rather than negligence?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. But
Mr. Hildebrand, let's see. Mrs. Alvarado should recover, in your view, because Mr. Kelleher didn't open the cabinet, and really there was a duty to open all of those cabinets in the interests of safety. Is that?
There was a duty to inspect the property, yes.
If somehow the painters had been injured rather than Mrs. Alvarado, same result in your view that the...
If the painters would establish negligence and cause, yes, because they're lawfully in the apartment. Mrs. Alvarado was lawfully in the apartment. And it's kind of interesting because if you read Judge Bartel's opinion, she addressed public policy factors as far as the painters were concerned and concluded, I think appropriately so, that there were no public policy factors that would bar recovery by Mrs. Alvarado against the painters. My question is, why don't those same public policy factors apply here? The only thing you can say is that, well, Mrs. Alvarado was a cleaning lady and not a tenant. But that doesn't wash as far as...
Suppose we had an apartment in which there was no cleaning lady and no painters. It was only one person. It was Mr. Kelleher, opened the cabinet, found it, and was injured. The thing blew up. What's the result there?
Well, he could sue himself or his employer. But that's his job. His job, as in the manual, was to make these inspections. And actually, Your Honor, to be fair, you know what happened here? It's the move-out time. They don't have time to go through all these apartments and carefully inspect the way they're supposed to do. It goes back to something I learned when I was a little boy. It's haste makes waste. And the question is here, because of the haste, because of the time of the year that this happened, who should bear the loss? Mrs. Kelleher, whose hand was blown off, or the apartment owner that didn't have enough time or enough people to adequately inspect these apartments? And I say the answer is that the apartment owner should bear this loss. Thank you, Your Honors. I'm out of time. It's always a privilege to appear.
Thank you, Mr. Hildebrand. Thank you, Mr. Nelson. That concludes our hearing on 01-1750, Alvarado versus Search. Now, the students will remain, and anyone else who wishes to participate in the discussion with Justice Prosser may stay, and Justice Prosser will be out in a few moments. The court is adjourned for its March sitting, but has a conference at 1:30.